From the EAH team, welcome to Everything About Hydrogen. This is the podcast that explores the world of hydrogen and its derivative technologies and interrogates how it is changing the world of energy as we know it. Join host Patrick Malloy, Principal of the Breakthrough Technologies Group at RMI, Alicia Eastman, Co-Founder and Board Director of Intercontinental Energy, and Chris Jackson, CEO of Protium, as the team speak to some of the most innovative and exciting players in the industry. If you are a fan of the show, we would absolutely love if you would leave us a five-star review for Everything About Hydrogen, wherever you get your podcast from. It really does help boost us up the charts and help people to find us. And with that, I'll leave it to the team and let's get on with the show.
So, guests, you'll be surprised and shocked, as me and Alicia are, to know that on this week's episode of Everything About Hydrogen, Patrick's video is actually on, which is something of a unique cultural experience for us as co-hosts of Everything About Hydrogen. So, in deference to that very unique and momentous change of pace, Patrick, do you want to kick us off? What have you been up to in the last couple of weeks?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I've been using AI for the last 2.5-3 years. So, this is actually my... It's the joys of new laptops, right, that have working cameras across multiple streams. So for the last week, what have I been doing? Well, I had the pleasure and good fortune to go to CERAWeek just last week, which... for those who don't know, is a major energy conference in Houston, Texas. Historically, it's a major kind of gathering for the traditional oil and gas players. But we had two general stages, one focused on kind of hydrogen directly, and actually there was three public stages, if you will. One on hydrogen, one on carbon, and one on, I think, climate or climate change related solutions. I forget what its formal title is, but so that was nice to see, but also great to see such a vibrant and strong ecosystem. Great to see so many folks from the, shall we say, the green end of the spectrum also there. So it was quite balanced, I think, relative to kind of being a traditional kind of ONG centric conference. The reason I say that is because if you were watching the news or reading the newspaper, you'd have heard the various statements from CEOs of a number of companies telling us how unaffordable everything is but their product. And I think it's important to know that that wasn't necessarily the consensus of the actual event. So lots to talk about, lots to do, but also just really, really quite cool to see. What about you, Alicia, seeing as we're passing the torch around the table?
I'm very happy for this proof of life. I've been asking for it for a while, so we're happy to see your face. I just got back from Geneva. I was at the 11th session of the UNECE GEG. So I am now winning all of the acronyms. It took me a while to get at that mouthful. But basically, it's the group of experts who are discussing and understanding different uses of clean hydrogen and derivatives. So I am going to be leading the ammonia pathway. And so obviously that I'm very happy about that because that is everything that I'm always talking about. So it's good. It was really interesting. And there's actually a lot going on that I had not heard about in terms of different projects in Scandinavia, in Norway, a lot of different things happening that are going to bring a lot of hydrogen to the market, which is really exciting. And then came back just in time to talk to Chris and get an interview in.
Yeah, it was nice to get to squeak one in. It's been, as sort of you guys obviously know, and listeners may have sort of heard me talk about before, this, I think this year has been one of the more intense, crazy starts to the year. Obviously, lots of things going on in the world, but I think combination of, at least on the home front, the hydrogen allocation round, second round of the UK of April 19th, and fundraising and personal life combination has made it difficult to do as many of these as I would have liked to. So it was a real pleasure to have Frank Wouters, who obviously is coming through later, is always really excited to have people who come on who bring incredible depth and knowledge and experience. And Alicia, very kindly, obviously you made the introduction there across, but I had the pleasure of meeting Frank in Dubai briefly before as well. A friend from the World Bank, Susanna Dobrokova, had told me about it before as well. And just such a nice guy and so unbelievably bright. So it'll be really exciting to hear what he has to say when we get him on later.
Definitely. I mean, he's probably the most experienced in this space in the world. It's hard to think of somebody who has been more engaged, you know, for the last 30 years, 5 books. I mean, it's just a lot. And he's still such a wonderful guy. He's really patient, I think, with other people and explaining how things can work. So it was great to have him on, and some of the new things that he's involved in that are new ways to look at the market and new ways to sort of encourage and advance the use of alternative fuels. So I think the listeners can see for themselves if they enjoy his conversation, but I think it was really interesting, as he always is. Frank, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. What about yourself?
Good, very good, actually. A lot of interesting things happening this year, especially projects that you're involved in, actually. So everything is pretty exciting. Before we get started on questions about what you've been up to recently, it would just be great to have a little background on how you got to where you are, how you fell into hydrogen. And I mean, obviously you've had a very, very long career in hydrogen. So it would be interesting to hear how that happened.
Yeah, sure. So actually, my first job right after college was a very interesting one. I was working at the Technology Development Advisory Unit of the University of Zambia, and my very first project was a wind pump. So I built a wind pump that provided water and for cattle and high-value crops. And the first location was a mission post just out of Lusaka. And you know, that sort of, you know, opened my eyes to what renewable energy can do. And when I went back to the Netherlands from my 3 years in Africa, I got a job in a consulting company that was engaged in, solar energy and wind. And this was the early 90s. So we were basically doing consulting because it was horrendously expensive and still very niche. But from that, knowledge base, we actually started developing other types of businesses. I then went to Germany, opened the German offices. And in the end, we did everything. We manufactured solar. We did large offshore wind projects all over the world, et cetera, et cetera. So if you will, I grew up, with the industry and never left. And about 10 years ago, I started thinking beyond electricity, because if you look at your energy system, electrons, which is renewable electricity, is 20% of all final energy and 80% are molecules. And then if you think that through, you don't have many options if you want to get rid of emissions. And hydrogen is, one of the top molecules that we are going to use in the future. And that will, be an indispensable part of our energy system going forward. So that's how, developed. And obviously, 10 years ago, it was the second or third wave of hydrogen activity. But the main difference was that we then had already, low cost green electricity, which makes it affordable and viable, which wasn't the case before. So that was the game changer, that we had green electricity that was cheap, so that we can make affordable green hydrogen, and that opened up everything.
Yeah, and it's I completely agree. And I mean, I remember this is one of the things that got us all excited at the World Bank. And obviously, Frank, for those listeners who aren't familiar, obviously you've done a lot actually on that multilateral side as well. And I certainly remember Susanna from ESMAP, again, sorry, I'm going to acronyms, but from the World Bank brain, I would say, or energy brain, always used to sing your praises and was hard to be praised by Susanna. So I was always like, okay, God, Frank's this is a serious guy. So it was also good to meet you in Dubai actually last year and hear about what you were doing there. I guess, there's so many things we could cover in terms of hydrogen with you, Frank. I mean, I think the question that sort of immediately jumped to mind a little bit was, what do you think is actually missing in the current state of the hydrogen market? Because this market, as you rightly said, has had several attempts to get going. You described a little bit why you think it's different this time compared to previous, obviously the cost of power. Maybe just talk us through from sort of the position you have and from the experience you have, what's the gap still that we need to work on? And, you know, and be specific if you're feeling brave, who would you point the finger to as people who probably have the most work to do to get the market into that place?
Yeah, I think that's a relatively straightforward one, because I think at the moment the ball is in the court of the governments. I mean, this is, you know, this massive transformation of how you produce, transport, and use energy, you know, which we have to go through in the next couple of decades. And it's really urgent. I mean, we had, you know, peak emissions last year. They still keep going up. We had the warmest January in the history, et cetera. So we're in a real, you know, difficult situation. So there's no time to lose. But if I look at then, you know, very specifically at hydrogen, the last couple of years, the number of projects keeps growing. I mean, the pipeline of, let's say, large-scale projects, I think it's now more than 1,000, you know, globally. But the number of projects that reach some level of financial maturity, that is lagging tremendously. So, you know, if you look at it, then there is still something missing. We're not reaching FIDs, so final investment decisions, enough. And I think there is a couple of regulatory gaps. And the ball is, in my view, really in the court of the government. Something has to happen in addition to what they're trying. And if you then look at the major governments that are active in, you know, in trying to build a hydrogen economy, I mean, everybody on the planet is to some extent, but Europe is, for example, leading because Europe is a net energy importer and will remain so in the future. There is just no way that you can make all the green electricity in Europe, or green molecules for that matter. So they have a very clear hydrogen strategy, which even you know, ambition was increased after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, etc. And still, you know, there is a multitude of regulatory frameworks, whether it's in the fuels, whether it's financial, whether it's quotas, obligations, and everything. But still, people are not making those investments. So I do think that we have to rethink also to some extent the complexity of the measures. I was going through a document just today about, you know, what Europe is trying to do in trying to create demand, in trying to, you know, provide funding for production, in making investments in infrastructure, etc. But we're still not doing enough. And again, you know, that is at this point in time for governments to come up with something better. And, you know, in my view, what we need is a bit more simplicity. And also, if I look back at, you know, what got renewable energy going, that was a very simple mechanism of a fixed feed-in tariff, which the Germans championed, and I really like that principle. I mean, I've looked at it again and again, and you know the beauty of the Renewable Energy Act that the Germans did was its simplicity. I mean, everybody had the right to feed electricity into the grid if it was you know, made using solar or wind or biomass. And you got a fixed feed-in tariff for 20 years. Nobody could tell you no. It was a law, and you had the right to do so. And that really got the ball rolling. You know, the other beauty of the system was that it was not a tax and spend system. So basically, the cost difference between the more expensive renewable energy at the time and the baseline, that was passed on by the local utility, which had to pay you, to the national high voltage pool, where it was spread out over all energy customers. And, you know, it was first of all very simple, but it was also non-discriminatory, and it was not tax and spend, so politically extremely robust. Mind you, the system was invented by the coalition of the Green and the Red, so the social Democrats, and they then lost the election. But because it wasn't a tax system, then when Angela Merkel and the Christian Democrats came into power, they looked around them. They saw that all the farmers had PV systems on the sheds, and they had wind turbines on their farms, and it didn't cost them anything. So she didn't change it. It was politically extremely robust. Obviously, there is a couple of tricks that you have to consider. You know, there is a risk of overpaying if you're, you know, especially if you're in a very dynamic situation where cost goes down very quickly because you're creating that market. Then the risk is, of course, that you overpay people. But that, you know, that you can do. that is not rocket science. You just have to be quick at it and modify those feed-in tariffs. And over time, what happened was that, you know, in the end, the cost differential, you know, went to zero. Right now, it's cheaper than conventional or other forms of power generation. And if you need more power now, the German government goes for auctions. So that is also something to consider for hydrogen. Now, the difference with hydrogen is that you don't have a grid everywhere. So the beauty of the renewable energy law in Germany was that you had a grid everywhere, so it's easy to do. For hydrogen, you have to think it, you know, through a little bit. You have to probably decouple, let's say, the production of the molecule from the green quality and you know, make a certificate out of it. And then, you know, the cost differential for those certificates, you know, you collect them on a national pool or a regional pool, whichever is the entity that is running with the system. And then you spread out the cost differential over all customers. But you can basically do it in a very similar way as the renewable energy.
But I think, Frank, if I can come in there on that, I mean, I think it's just because I think it is really interesting looking at how the renewable power sector worked. And, you know, I think no one would deny that the German government policy was critical to the solar industry and arguably to the onshore wind industry as well. I think you're absolutely right. And the way you describe it, it was a really flagship piece of legislation. I guess the thing that I wanted to pick up on that was there was, you know, your comment immediately was governments have to deal with this. And my sort of slight observational challenge to that at the moment is to say, isn't this really actually a problem about investors and deployment of capital? And I take the point that these mechanisms have been very effective from governments. But I guess my point is governments need, essentially at the moment, certainly Western countries need additional financial resources to be able to make these commitments, right? Because whether it's war in Ukraine or healthcare or any of the number of issues that are going on, there is not a lot of spare capital available in Western European economies and in the United States to fund these kinds of measures. And without some kind of tax system that gives them more capital to go and do these things, they won't get there. So to my mind, it feels like investors have to make a choice, which is either take more risk, but maybe higher returns and fund it yourself, or pay more tax to give the government the financial resources so that they can introduce these kind of measures. And I just wanted to put that sort of challenge back to you and ask how you feel about that.
Yeah, so, I mean, there is two angles to that question. One is that, you know, the Renewable Energy Act that Germany did didn't cost the government any money. So basically, you socialize the cost through, you know, a system of central pooling, and then you spread it out over energy customers. So it's closed within, you know, without any government interference. So in that sense, I mean, that's the beauty of that, because it's politically very robust, and you're not competing with healthcare and wars and all kinds of other worthy causes, if you will. The question about availability of capital or the risk appetite, I mean, that really depends on your return on investment. And at the moment, you know, we still have a cost gap to cover. And the question is, like, why would a private investor, you know, try to pay more for something, you know, on top of maybe a carbon price, which we have in Europe, but, you know, not in many other parts of the world. So the question is really, what is the business case? And I think the business case at this point in time still depends a lot on regulatory regimes and frameworks, you know, quotas, obligations, you know, all of the things that you have as a government to make a change that is maybe not something the market will do in the short term. So in the end, you know, there will be more and more market, but at the moment there is just no market because the cost differential is just there. And why would you pay more for something? In the end, a molecule is a molecule, an electron is an electron.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that it's very difficult to extricate energy from government, which is why you see a lot of fossil fuels and oil and gas having a lot of government support, because that security of energy is, you know, really important to every single country. And if that's going to be the case, that there are actually subsidies going to competition of green options, then there should also be government support of the green options. Because at the end of the day, what we want is security of energy, and we want it to be reasonably priced, and we want it to be clean. So it really is in the government's, I think, in the place to support this and to probably stop supporting fossil fuels as much in ways that people are not aware. Because obviously it's not, everything is not internalized. So it seems cheap, But is it really cheap if everyone's going to the hospital or people are dying younger? Or, you know, there's lots of outcomes from fossil fuels that are just not included in the price. And so I think you're the one who told me this, that it's very difficult to extract energy from governments. And I think that's really the case. So I would actually love to hear you talk a little bit about the Zero Emissions Trade Alliance, the ZETA, which you guys have launched recently, because I think you are trying to help this move along. And it would be great to hear why you launched it and what impact you think it's going to have.
Yeah, thanks. So basically, ZETA was launched in recognition of the fact that at the moment, there is just not much out there in terms of, you know, trade and how do you trade and, you know, what are enablers for trade, and also recognizing the fact that trade in the end are parts of a liquid market that, you know, is in the end cost effective when will bring more cost effective energy to end consumers. And, you know, it's part of trying to get to a place where we have markets for green molecules. At the moment, we don't. I mean, there is no real market for green molecules. You can buy cargoes of LNG and shiploads of coal and obviously tankers with oil, you know, left, right and center. But that is still, yeah, some time away from us for green molecules. But we have to start somewhere. And part of what ZETA is trying to do is create awareness about, you know, the benefits of trades, but also start a conversation about, you know, what are enablers for trade? What are marketplaces? What do they look like? You know, how do you price carbon? How do you organize certification, you know, that guarantee the greenness or the quality of a molecule that you make somewhere so that you can actually get it recognized in other markets where you have certain standards, et cetera, et cetera. And it's building on the experience that, you know, especially Paul van Zon, the president of DII Desert Energy, had, because he founded the European Traders Association back in the day. And that has also, you know, done a lot of efficiency improvements in the European energy markets. And basically, that's it. We try to always be ahead of the curve a little bit with DII Desert Energy, and ZETA is right there. I mean, if you look at the region here in the Gulf, you know, Saudi has started a voluntary carbon market on the stock exchange, you know, the same in the UAE. So we have to support all these initiatives, make them better, make them more ambitious, and in the end, you know, make them also tools for compulsory carbon markets. Because in the end, you know, what we do need is a price on carbon. I think that is something that, you know, 5 years ago in this region was still somewhat taboo. But I do think that everybody now recognizes that carbon pricing is important. Only 25% of all emissions in the world have a price, so 75% don't. And that is just not a good thing, because we're just wasting carbon. We're using the atmosphere as an open sewer because, you know, who cares? And carbon pricing is, you know, it's a very cost-effective way to reduce emissions. And, you know, that's what we like to support.
So you're doing, there'll be some kind of offsets, or, you know, basically separating, as you said before, the green characteristics from the fuels. Are you also looking at book and claim, some other ways to, because I think book and claim will be a really helpful thing in the nascent sort of green shipping industry, because obviously they're everywhere and there's not going to be fuel everywhere. And you can basically, if you have a certification and it's, you can say it's the same product, it's a good solution. Is that something you're also considering?
Yeah, we're big fans of book and claim. Unfortunately, the European Commission is not. So the European Commission is working on mass balance. And, you know, we sort of guess the reason. I mean, there has been some really bad experience, especially in the biomass sphere. And that is why, you know, they now want to feel and touch every molecule, which, you know, is in my view unnecessary if you can build a system that's robust enough to create trust that you need. I mean, that is part of the issue with book and claim, because you're going to recognize things that are happening in faraway countries all over the world where your transparency may not be as high as next door in your own country. But, you know, we should really try. because book and claim would definitely be much better than what we're trying to do now, which really limits the growth of green molecules in the short term.
No, super interesting. And I think actually one thing, because questions I wanted to sort of ask a little bit off the back of that, as listeners know, we always have a list of questions we go through, but so I'm going a little bit off piste here, but I just got excited listening to you guys talk about this, so I thought I wanted to come back to it. The European CBAM approach, has that actually been helpful in this context, right? I mean, you know, certainly some people, Americans, normally don't like CBAM very much, you know, for obvious reasons. I think someone was saying in the FT that they have a specifically large section dedicated to why they dislike the European approach. But it does seem to my mind that actually the carbon border adjustment mechanism has been sort of the tonic needed to force the global issue on this. I just wonder what your thoughts were.
I agree. I mean, from a European perspective, you want to reduce emissions inside the European Union, then obviously you have to do something at the border. Because otherwise, you know, you would have what we like to call carbon leakage. You know, if you have high standards for the steel industry in Europe, and then you allow people to export into Europe with a much higher carbon footprint, that's not fair for European industry. So that's why you have the carbon tax at the border. I do recognize that it poses difficulties for many, let's say, developing and emerging economies that are exporting to Europe, because then they need to make investments to reduce the carbon footprint of the product. Otherwise, the market will be closed for them. And there I would hope that Europe is a little bit more proactive in providing the capital for such investments. One of the things that somebody pointed out from a sub-Saharan Africa country, what Europe does with the tax at the border is to put it into the innovation fund, so thereby increasing Europe's competitiveness compared to the outside world, whereby the European industry is already way more competitive than, for example, the industry in sub-Saharan Africa. So then you're going to, let's say, force a sub-Saharan African, and I'm just using that as an example, you know, to make an investment in reducing emissions so they can then actually, you know, export to Europe. And if they wouldn't, then, you know, they have to pay a tax, and that tax money would go towards European industry's competitiveness, which is already better than theirs. So, you know, that's from that perspective, doesn't sound entirely fair. And perhaps we could share a little bit more of that money and share it with the entire planet to become, more efficient than just Europe. CBAM, it's going to be an interesting journey. What we are seeing, by the way, is that, you know, especially neighbors like Turkey, but also in the Gulf, investments are being made. And that's not per se a bad thing, because that will also increase their competitiveness in the future. You're just more future proof if you have low carbon products, because, you know, we are going to be in an increasingly carbon constrained world, and, you know, it will provide an incentive for people to build factories of the future.
And actually, I think this feeds into one of the questions I wanted to say. I mean, just as a comment on that, I do wonder whether this mythical idea of leapfrogging, which I remember at the World Bank was always a very popular topic, actually does CBAM, completely taking your point about competitiveness, but my observation or my wonder is actually whether leapfrogging gets a massive boost from this, because if you are considering new infrastructure and what you do, if you know that it is going to put you at an immediate cost competitive disadvantage by putting in fossil fuels, and you've not put any infrastructure in place already, why would you bother going anything but green from day one? And so actually you're sort of, I deserve, you're probably giving them a bit of a nudge in that regard that probably is no bad thing. And that did feed through to supply chain. And I guess this was a question I wanted to ask you, because supply chain has become, especially in the hydrogen context, and this is a hydrogen podcast, even though we do go beyond the hydrogen brief, supply chains become quite topical at the moment, whether it's because the IRA legislation is very specific on supply chain and what you're allowed to do with regards to hydrogen, whether it's even some of the European legislation around that. Even the UK is looking at this quite closely. UK government subsidy is very closely looking at supply chain and local content as part of it. how do we create this sort of dynamic whereby we need to drive down costs, and often driving down costs means going to the most cost-efficient places to manufacture these things, and that's often not the West, it is other markets, and going to those markets, as you point out, does create jobs, does lift people from poverty, and all these things that are also good social things we want to do, and that also feed back to climate, because jobs, creation, wealth means you can invest in sustainability. So all of these things do virtuously feed back, but set aside this fear that people are seeing or worried about deindustrialization of Europe and the US, that being a very politically contentious issue, and worried about IP theft, which in some cases may be not legitimate and in others is a very real and very serious and is actually happening. So how do you, when you're thinking about the growth of the hydrogen supply chain, how do you feel we can, you know, or if you were sitting in a room with policymakers trying to give them a gentle nudge, what would you tell them to be focusing on? And maybe what would you say that they're worrying too much about and actually isn't that important to do today?
Yeah, I mean, that is a tough one, especially if you're looking at, key technology components, because in the end, you know, what we're going to do is switching away from, let's say, a resource-based energy system to a technology-based energy system. It's all conversion of sunshine, wind, and water using a piece of equipment that somebody has to make. And then if we look at the current situation, more than half of all new additions last year were solar in the world of power generation capacity, then 96% of the wafers come from one province in one country. That is probably not a healthy situation from any perspective, whether you like the politics or not, just from any risk perspective, that is just not healthy. So we need to diversify and, hopefully get into, let's say, somewhat level playing field where everybody who, makes a good, solid piece of kit that's cost effective can play. But at the moment, it's a difficult situation. You also need to take into account that if you look around you, I forgot the number, but a huge number of elections this year. There's a huge trend towards nationalization. All the new governments have nationalistic trends where, the threats about trade wars, et cetera, are being thrown around left, right, and center. So, all of that needs to be taken into account. And then, to the point, we also need to, enable developing and emerging economies, being part of this and not just, being buyers of foreign stuff. But then you need to look at the scale. Part of why a lot of this equipment is cheap now, it's because we've gone to tremendous scale. So you need a market around you that can support that scale, and that is very often the challenge in many developing countries. But nonetheless, you should try. And local content regulations are very popular. They've been blooming, especially here in the Gulf. Every country, sometimes even parts of countries, have their own set of rules, also in many developing countries, we see this growing. But you also have to be mindful that it's not that straightforward. I haven't seen much evidence that all the local content regulation that countries have done have actually yielded much in terms of job creation. Also, cost has often gone up, et cetera, et cetera. So you really have to look hard at how are you going to do this. Then, of course, you don't want to be in a situation where you're not compliant with WTO trade rules, et cetera, et cetera. So these are some of the things that we have to consider. But then, if I look at Europe and the US, Europe doesn't want to be in any sort of a trade war. That's not the trend that I've seen in Europe for the last couple of decades. I think you have to really look hard if you're trying to make an electrolyzer in Europe, and how are you going to be competing with the Chinese in the years to come. That is not going to be that straightforward if, the trade situation isn't entirely fair, which it doesn't seem to be. But then if you don't want to get into a trade war, then what's going to happen? I don't know.
Well, I definitely think that we would do well with a lot of diversity by geography and technology. because we do have these inputs into the supply chain that some are not readily available, some are difficult to get. And so if you have different technologies, some don't need platinum group metals, some do. I mean, that's all going to help us to, I think, be more resilient in our supply chains. And I think people are realizing that. And I don't think we're ever going to lose Ricardo. Like, comparative advantage is always going to make sense. And when it's cheaper for everyone, I think you do eventually end up down that road, because it's just untenable to keep things in you know, one very expensive country. And it makes a lot of sense to, even they will outsource a number of components of whatever it is that they're producing to different places. So I think it bodes well for being globalist just naturally, because it ends up being so much cheaper for everyone. But I think we just need to keep an eye out on not putting 90% of one product in one country, or having, cornered markets essentially for different things. I also wanted to ask another question, which sort of ties in with this, and this concept that, you know, it's funny, I run into this in Europe a lot, this idea that we need to do this and we need to do that. And it's very European, like they're only talking about for Europe. And you do that, get that in the United States as well, but I don't hear that type of thinking anywhere else. Like, it's more of a global way of thinking. But in Europe, it's, I think, burned once, burned twice. I think Europe is more like, they're not taking our turbines, they're not taking our electrolyzers away, they already took the solar. This is sort of the feeling. And then the U.S. is, despite what they say, has always been very protectionist in a lot of ways. But so there is something that you've just started, another acronym. That's sort of my area of expertise on this show. So you have the Mediterranean Green Electrons and Molecules, the MedGEM network, which is seeking to address some of the Global South issues and sort of make this more fair, probably more resilient.
Yeah, thanks. So basically last year we started the network. I mean, we get funding from the European Union. And basically, we're working with the southern Mediterranean neighbors. So it stretches from Morocco all the way to Lebanon. So it's also eastern Mediterranean. And we are now negotiating with Mauritania to be also part of the network. And what we're trying to do is basically, provide a platform for countries to come together and debate. And we basically cover four topics. We look at regulatory regime, we look at infrastructure, we look at industry development and investments in finance. You know, basically the typical approach is that we take stock in the country. We go to, to do a national consultation workshop and see what's missing, where can we help. Because mind you, it's a crowded place. I mean, wherever we go, there is EBRD and World Bank and UNIDO and IRENA, and everybody's doing hydrogen stuff. So we also have to be mindful of that fact, that we need to, cooperate and coordinate a bit better when you're working with these countries. But that has, has really clicked very well. And you know, what we're trying to do is, learn from each other. And one great example that I like to mention is Oman. You know, Oman has, taken a number of very interesting steps. The government set up this company called Hydrom, which is, the national champion that is in charge of building common infrastructure, but also doing the auction process for land allocation. That is for me a blueprint of what many other countries could look at to follow, because I'm seeing many countries sort of like a similar situation evolving, where you have, let's say, land and great resources, and then you have a lot of private sector people that come in and claim land and start initial development, etc. But then very quickly, you look at the situation, you're thinking, okay, is everybody going to build pipelines? Is everybody going to build desalination plants? I mean, do we have place for that? How does that work, etc.? So then you have to go as a government, take a slightly more proactive role than what we're seeing at the moment, and be that landlord, if you will. That orchestrator of a sector that is entirely new, but has great promise, because that's the great promise of this stuff in the region. Whenever you have low-cost available electricity or any kind of energy, you have industrial development. That's something that we've seen in the last 200 years. Why would it be any different now? Now we're seeing, you know, the tremendous growth of the promise of green electricity and green molecules in those regions. That can actually really kickstart something entirely new. And that's the beauty of this whole thing, you know. And then, you know, why is Europe sponsoring this? A number of things. One is that Europe needs imports. And then, you know, the closest you are, the better it is. So you look at your neighbors and you help them, you know, try to get their heads around this. You know, that's why they give the support. But also industrial development in the neighboring countries is also helpful from many angles for Europe. That's why Europe is supporting this.
I definitely agree with you. I mean, I think obviously most of the wars have been fought over resources in our history, and the disparity between very wealthy countries and countries that really just have not are struggling. And I think it's just a great thing that we can have an opportunity to make these economies more complex, to provide somewhat of an infrastructure for them to build different industries and to be a magnet for other industries that are energy intensive and moving from needing dirty energy to clean energy. And that is exciting to see other countries finally get to get some of this wealth from the industry. We were out of time, but we could ask you a million questions more and still be learning. So I just want to thank you so much for being on the show. I'm sure people will have learned a lot about it, and also just what you've been doing for your entire career. It's really just amazing for everyone.
Thank you.
So guys, very, very wide-ranging conversation with Frank and a lot of material there that we could pick up on. I mean, Alicia, you did warn me in advance that this is a gentleman whose CV is sort of, you know, booklet size and length. I mean, maybe just for some of our listeners to get a feel for it, you know, some of the things he's done, you know, he's a bit too humble to talk about it. Maybe you could just kind of, as it were, pick out some of the greatest hits from his CV.
Sure. I mean, actually, he's one of these people who has such an incredible background that they don't have a long CV. They have nothing to prove. So he doesn't have 40 pages. He just has bullet points that are incredible. So he's been leading renewable energy projects, transactions, technology development for over 30 years. He served as deputy director general of IRENA, International Renewable Energy Agency, from 2012 to 2014. And he's been on the board of a lot of energy companies in Europe, Asia, the US, and Africa. So he's currently the chairman of the MENA Hydrogen Alliance. He's also the chairman of the DII Advisory Board. So DII Desert Tech and MENA Hydrogen Alliance work together, and they get incredible speakers and do these amazing tours. And there's a big link between the Middle East and Europe. And so there's a lot of back and forth there. It's a great group for connecting people and to get projects moving. He's now the director of the EU MedGem Network, which he talked about in the interview, so you can understand a little bit more of that. That's a very new initiative. And he's been the chairman of just a lot of companies. I don't think I can list them all. He's written, I think, 5 books on renewable energy and green hydrogen in particular. He's an expert on pipelines. I mean, it's really there's not enough time, I think, to get into how amazing he is. But Patrick, since you weren't in the interview, I'm just wondering what you think about the new endeavor that he's involved in, ZETA, the Zero Emissions Trade Alliance, and how maybe decoupling the fuel from its green properties or its clean properties, how that could be successful or what might go wrong with it. What I'm wondering what your thoughts were after we talked about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an appropriate moment to have that sort of a conversation at a high level, right? It's you know, there is a need for some level of book and claim style structure where attribute linkages are not immediately dependent on the molecule, pure a molecule of origin point. I think there's a huge amount of interest in that, and that's manifest from the amount of you know, multi-sectoral interest in those sort of systems that's emerging. Is this complex? Without question. And Frank, to give him some credit, given the resume that you just described, or the lack of resume that you just described with the bullet points, you probably need that level of experience and exposure across the sector to really understand the kind of directional complexity of what you're trying to get into. There's obviously some ongoing questions about the role of these style of systems within, I'm thinking particularly related to the GHG protocol settings, and also, you know, for transparency on the consumer side around how you recognize those kind of credit structures in a standard reporting, or whether across the various kind of carbon accounting structures that are folks use today across different sectors. And maybe one of the reflections here is, given that complexity, how they kind of establish this structure, how they build this thing, and how it comes to actually market, for lack of a better word, is going to be extremely important, but also ultimately the most challenging bit that I would reflect on. That does not for 1 minute take away from the simple fact and reality that these sort of structures and systems are coming. We're going to need them. Otherwise, we face a real risk of market stall, whether we're talking about, you know, a SAF market, whether we're talking about a various shipping fuels market, whether we're talking about even something as simple as just recognizing hydrogen molecule qualities and carbon intensities. These sort of structures are going to be critical. Therefore, we need these sort of things to come out into the world and succeed. But that's maybe a high level reflection. I still think it's a timely point, given where we are, given what we're seeing out of the IMO, given what we're seeing across multiple different sectors. So maybe Chris, what about you?
It's a very timely conversation, right? Because I think, especially, you know, thinking about CERAWeek, which we opened the episode about, where, you know, you had this comment and it's been repeated all over the papers. And again, it's on the papers this weekend. So giving our listeners a sign of when we do some of these recordings. But, you know, the idea that the energy transition is too expensive, right? And the idea that, you know, we can't afford to do this. This is a narrative that the fossil fuel industry is trying really hard to push, because they are realizing this is existential for them now. They're kind of, I think, realizing that this is their moment to push. And if they don't do it now, then it's game over. It might not be game over tomorrow, but it's the path is set and there's no getting away, right? The train is leaving the station. So I think in that context, talking about things like, you know, global carbon taxing, and how do you actually do that properly, and how do you create a framework for truly assessing carbon, and, you know, the work that Alicia has been doing, you know, with people like the World Trade Organization to sort of come up with a comprehensive global standard for how do you measure, you know, what is sort of green ammonia, as it were, right? And, you know, all these sort of endeavors, I think this is the moment. I think, though, the other challenge in some of this is that we saw Frank talk a lot about the role of government, right? And Frank sort of very much was of the view that this is where government has to step in, and only government can lead this. And I think I still struggle with that, right? Because ultimately, the only way that government can make this work is with the resources that ultimately are held by the private sector, right? And so I guess I just find it a fairly damning indictment of supposedly a, you know, capitalistic private sort of sector world, where we're saying, you know, we believe, and I am a capitalist, right? I mean, I believe that in general, capitalism has been one of the most incredible forces for economic development and growth in human history, but you have to point it in the right direction to get outcomes and results. And for some reason, we seem to have completely lost our ability to channel all those incentives and motivations towards outcomes that we want. And I'm just absolutely staggered that people are saying, I'd rather the government taxed me more and then wasted even more money in the process of collecting the tax, structuring mechanism regimes, and trying to distribute money that way, than actually I go and do this myself. Because if the private sector could be bothered to do this themselves, they would do it far faster and far cheaper and ultimately more efficiently. And so this idea that everyone just has to pay, the government has to step in, well, the only way the government steps in is if everyone pays more tax. And I just find that it's probably where we're going to have to go, but it was just quite depressing, I guess, having that conversation, especially given that Frank has clearly sat on many sides of the table. You know, he sat on the government advisory side, he sat on the private sector side, and I guess it's just it was a little bit shocking. I don't know if any listeners also have been recently watching Netflix's Three Body Problem. It's a very famous book series that won a lot of the first science fiction awards in China, first Chinese author to win science fiction awards. But one of the sort of arching concepts of it is that humanity can't save itself. And I have to say, listening to Frank a little bit and listening to some of these ideas, you do get to this quite stark and depressing thought process where you go, are we really that incapable with all these bright minds of doing what is so patently obvious in front of us, which is to say, we just need to pay more and people just need to start taking the hit and people can patently afford to do that. And I don't know, I thought that was shocking in some ways.
In one go, you have both depressed our listeners and also ruined the three-body problem as a book and TV show. God, outrageous, Chris. Alicia, your thoughts are hopefully more positive than that.
I mean, I think it's refreshing to hear real politic coming out in favor of something positive, right? He's basically saying that energy is infrastructure and it's necessary. It's so necessary that the government is always going to be involved. The government will be involved with energy. It will be involved with water. It will be involved with basics, like the basics, because otherwise the government is out. They will not get voted back in. You know, what happens when the price of oil goes up? I mean, these governments, they will be out. We've lost many presidents and many different parties lose. It's a political problem, and it is almost possible to pull it away from government, I think. So they have to play a role. They will play a role. And so the thing is that how do you work with the government in the best way so that it's done correctly? And I think that's kind of what Patrick was saying. It's all in the way that you structure it. It is complicated. It does come down to the details and it is difficult, but it is also necessary, I think.
But it was interesting to hear him talk about, you know, Germany, for example, right? And you know, Frank made the case, you know, was very eloquent in saying that he felt that the German model with regards to catalyzing solar and wind and the way that that was structured in such a manner that actually politically it was very hard to attack at the time because it had something for everyone and the way that costs were socialized was very effective. You know, the irony is that many people today would actually say that policy has been a failure for Germany. Ironically, because many people would turn around and go, the country's using more coal, has much higher energy bills than many of its European peers. It ended up with a massive amount of outsourcing of what had been a very successful domestic solar industry that got wiped out by China. And effectively, they did subsidize the entire Chinese economy to grow and compete. And so it's not that I don't think the government has a role. I think, you know, evidently, if Germany hadn't done what it did, and, you know, Frank made that case, we probably wouldn't have had the solar revolution that we've had, right? And if you look at offshore wind, you know, the UK wouldn't have been able to, you know, the offshore industry wouldn't have grown without the UK government price support, frankly, that meant that at one point in time, 50% of all offshore wind in the world was the UK. I mean, it's only very recently that China's overtaken the UK as the offshore wind capital, and even then, not by the sort of orders of magnitude that you've seen in things like solar and onshore wind, and all of that has been policy driven. So I can acknowledge all those things, but I also feel like these are different times. You know, the average GDP to debt ratio in most Western countries is nearing 100% or over 100%. You know, these are countries that don't have that same sort of willingness. And a lot of things have been easy. You know, you already got a grid, you put power in the grid, you subsidize it, that kind of works. But actually changing people's cars, changing trucks, changing how you heat homes, changing how you fly planes, changing how you cook, that is really invasive. And that can't happen without ultimately all of us, the public, having to do more. And I wondered whether Frank would come in on that and say, actually, there is a role for World Bank, IMO, you know, or other kind of civic groups to try and also build this sort of sense amongst people of, like, you know, this is also a cultural mindset thing as much as it is a government incentives thing, right? You know, you also have to get people moving in that direction of travel to see change. You know, and Elon Musk is an example of that. I have at the moment, partly because I've been reading the Walter Isaacson autobiography, but we wouldn't be doing what we're doing in space if it wasn't for what they've done with SpaceX. And to some extent, we wouldn't have the EV revolution we'd had without Tesla. So, you know, you do think the private sector must be doing more or could be doing more.
Well, so there's kind of two follow-on points here, right? The first is, and appreciate where you're kind of taking it on the policy push. I think that's to some degree reasonable, but also fundamentally, the German solar support, I'm particularly thinking of that, was designed to set up a solar industry. And inevitably, as it matured, as that market came in, we saw the maturing of a market in the very same ways that you expect within a capitalist structure, which is market it forms, people invest capital, efficiency allocation of that capital to sell more effectively and compete effectively causes some winners and some losers to occur. And in this case, the Chinese government or the Chinese whatever ecosystem, I don't know how it works exactly, but invested a lot of money in developing a solar industry that was a world beater. And we've seen what the implications of that are. And hence, you know, in a lot of these industries that are connected to the area that we talk about, folks are actually quite considered about onshoring and supply chain kind of stability and disruptions and things like that now, right? So there's learnings within the system. The other side of this is, and I think this is a pertinent point, when we talk about the hydrogen hub allocations here in the US, there's $6-7 billion or, you know, $7-8 billion, depending on how much gets allocated formally to the hubs themselves, because that is also a process. You'd swear that it was just here's your money. It's a far more complicated position as to how much these hubs get and who gets what aspect of it. That has mobilized, I think it's something like 5 or 6x in equivalent private sector resources. And it's not to say that those investments would not have occurred over the coming few years. It's to say that investment by government in the form of what are tax credits enables those, well, it's not only the tax credits, it's obviously $1 billion, but there's also the tax credit structures, enables an acceleration and a more systemic thinking approach to these problems. So there is a balance role here between where good policy lives and what level of subsidy is productive versus what level of subsidy is keeping a dead beast alive, right? You know, the Tesla example, the SpaceX examples all got supports in the form of, you know, I believe it's NASA grants on SpaceX and now obviously direct contracting. And also, you know, Tesla has a storied career of getting very close to bankruptcy on several occasions. It's not that these are bad things. It's about that there's a natural ebb and flow in maturity in markets and maturity in companies. It's obviously clearer when you look at startups and everybody talks about valleys of death. That same thing occurs in markets in the same way. And you know, to seek support for some of these kind of transparency aspects that will be required in these offtakes markets to precisely change the car or the ship or the whatever else is not crazy. To your point, though, and you're right, asking for, you know, straight up handouts in the nature that we've seen perhaps in the past is not the way it's going to work going forward for a whole heap of reasons. So I think to give Frank some kudos here, I think what might be the play is more asking for smart, effective policy to mechanize and start to build momentum rather than just letting the natural wheels turn at a kind of a steady pace. But
now, one thing Frank was really good on and was really interesting was his, you know, we were talking also about developing countries and developing markets, right, and how that plays out and the impact of CBAM on them. And that was also a really interesting part of the discussion and very relevant to hydrogen, right? Because there's a lot of people saying that actually hydrogen should be and could be a very valuable thing for a lot of these markets, right? Because, you know, think about food security and the fact that actually it's a fuel that then they can export. And so, you know, you're allowing people to effectively, you know, in the same way that oil and gas windfalls are seen as this massive opportunity to help developing countries to kind of be able to tap into wealth that can invest in national infrastructure. The idea that actually your natural geography, your access to wind and your access to sunshine can actually become a resource that allows you to grow economically is also hugely, hugely appealing. So I think he did speak well to that. You know, but again, it was interesting because again, it is in this context of, you know, a CBAM type mechanism, but then with some kind of redistributive mechanism. And it also always comes back down to, again, people having to want to play together. And there's only so much government can do, and there's only so much, especially a lot of the government institutions in the developing world can do. And it really does have to be, I think, driven by the companies there if it's going to happen, right? You know, I think that was just my take, and it would have been interesting to have him maybe kind of talk into that a little more, right? You know, like the impact that a big mining site, for example, has in like a a place like West Africa or Congo, for example, you know, that private sector entity, that project entity can have far more impact on, you know, the country and what it does than necessarily the government. And the leapfrogging point that we were talking about to Frank, I think, is so important, because I remember this from the World Bank days. There was a bit, this is a huge topic in the development bank community, which is, does hydrogen with renewables allow you to potentially build an ecosystem and infrastructure that doesn't need to be fossil first? Because if you can just jump, if you can leapfrog and avoid putting any fossil infrastructure in the first place, that is a game changer. But if everyone starts building fossil infrastructure now the way that we've always done it, we're doomed, candidly. Like, we'll never get there, right? And I remember Nigeria was one of the big scares for people, because they were saying, you know, it's 180, 200 million people living there. It's forecast to be 450 million people by 2050. If they all want certain standard of life and quality of life, which we, you know, we'd all aspire to anywhere in the world, that can't be fossil. If it's fossil, it's, you know, take that plus Brazil plus India and Indonesia, and frankly, what Europe does is completely irrelevant. Frankly, even what Europe and the US does is irrelevant. So I thought that was also like an interesting part of the discussion, and maybe that would be one I'd love to get into for another episode. So if our listeners know any really cool startups working in leapfrog type applications with hydrogen, definitely get in touch. I think it'd be super interesting. But I enjoyed that one, and it would have been nice to maybe pick into it a bit more. Alicia, I want to pick you on that one. What was your take there? Because this is something close to your heart too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is like the whole reason for my whole career. I think, you know, we had Olivier Moussat on, you remember, with Atom. And what he's doing in Paraguay is just a great example of this, right? They were importing fertilizer that was made with fossil fuels, and now they are making their own with green hydrogen, and they are exporting it. And I think that is just a fantastic example. You know, it's not even my best use of hydrogen. You know, fertilizer is not my favorite, but that is a fantastic example of a country really making more from this and not having to, you know, put in more fossil fuels in order to make it work. And I think that's just, it's great. And we'd like to replicate that in as many places as possible. And I think it's not just the resource. It's not just the wind or the sun or the geothermal or the hydro that they might have, but it could also be they're part of the supply chain. They could be Southeast Asia. They're making electrolyzers. They're making solar panels so that we can diversify both in terms of geography, but also technology, so that we are also diversifying the raw materials that we need. I mean, I think it's great to have the whole world involved, essentially, and not have all the specialty in one place, and they're sort of giving this technology to poorer countries. I think it's great to have them developing it, you know, together. And it seems to be also working. The sad part of Sara was obviously some statements from Aramco and Exxon, but at the same time, Aqua and Masdar are like the largest renewables companies in the world, and they are doing huge hydrogen projects. And PIF is building huge hydrogen things in Saudi. So it's not like oil and gas won, and it's just a fossil fuel story. I think it's complicated. There's definitely a lot of people that are trying to maintain status quo, and there will always be people like that, right? I mean, that is the nature of people. But we do have options. So we can offer change that is actually positive in many ways, not just for the environment, but also for people's pockets and for lifestyle and for quality of life. There's lots of things that we can offer, but we kind of have to get on the same page, which is why I do think, you know, it doesn't have to be national governments, but I do think that the role of these international entities like the IMO and UN is important. I mean, I think there's a lot of good that they can do. It all comes down to the details again, and you know how much bureaucracy is in place. But for the most part, I think in this area, I think they're really moving. And I think IMO, we didn't talk about that, but that was in London this week for the MEPC 81. And I mean, they really are going to deliver on what they promised. And I think people are going to be pleasantly surprised by that. And they already are by how this last week went, even though they had to compete with CERAWeek. I think there's a lot of really positive things going on at the same time.
Well, maybe that's the way we should leave this one then, on a positive note. You know, IMO leading the way, which has definitely been a theme of the last few episodes. So
Yes, I think this episode may come up at the same time as the interview with Arsenio. So, you know, it's apt. We're doing a double header. So sorry, listeners who listen all the time, but at least you'll get two in relatively the same time period.
That was Everything About Hydrogen, hosted by the team Patrick Malloy, Alicia Eastman, and Chris Jackson. If you have a question for the Hydrogen team or any of our guests and would like to get in touch, you can shoot us an email on info@h2podcast.com. Or alternatively, you can follow us on LinkedIn or tweet us. Our handle is @abouthydrogen. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.